Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEdDean.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEdDean.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEdDean.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, and welcome to the 11th Bitcoin Standard podcast seminar. In today's seminar, we are going to be continuing on the topic we started with last week on Corona hysteria, which we had discussed with Jordan Schachtel last time. Today, I wanted to share more of my thoughts about what has been going on. But before that, I wanted to comment on two recent events in light of the topics that we had been covering recently. So first of all, if you look at the Bitcoin price at this point, it's at around 15,250 at the time of recording now. And I think it's interesting because this is exactly, I think, or roughly speaking, double the price at which the Bitcoin Standard was published. In fact, I remember when I sent the Bitcoin Standard to the publisher, Bitcoin was at around 7,000. And that's the final price that I had put into the book. And then by the time Bitcoin came out, it was also close to 7,000 or so, because it had gone up on the bull market last time, end of 2017, and then it came down. And by the time the book was out, it was already, I think, around 10 or something like that. But now, basically, it's up double what was in the book. So if you bought the book and, you know, you've been waiting to gloat and watch Bitcoin
price crash. And then, you know, it's been 2.5 years, so I'm sorry for your loss. It's still working as expected. And I think, you know, I don't really spend a lot of time elaborating on this, but I think I mentioned it in the seminar earlier. There was a seminar in which I discussed the difficulty adjustment. I still think, you know, the difficulty adjustment really is the magic sauce. And the explanation for why Bitcoin's price continues to go up. That's really the thesis that I put forward in the book, even though I don't spend much time dwelling on it. But it might, you know, in terms of economics, it might be the most powerful explanation we have for why Bitcoin's price goes up. And that's because the difficulty adjustment continues to ensure that the supply does not go up beyond what it has already been scheduled to go up. And so the amazing thing about this is that when we have these halving cycles, we end up with the number of new Bitcoins being mined every day dropping by half. And so the value of Bitcoin that comes, the new value of Bitcoin that comes onto the market drops by half. And so that means that, you know, new demand will have less supply to meet. And so if demand stays the same, you would expect that new supply not being enough would result in the price rising. And then the incredible thing then is that that in turn invites more people and more speculation into the into Bitcoin, which leads to it rising even more. And here's the thing, you know, what we like to call NGU technology or number go up technology. The insane thing about Bitcoin and why it's different from everything that we have ever seen is that when this mania happens and people are hearing about Bitcoin and they watch that Bitcoin's prices go up and they want to buy, you know, this can happen to anything and it has happened to all kinds of things all throughout human history. But the difference is that whenever it happens to anything, anywhere, that thing starts getting produced at increasing quantities. You know, somebody finds a way to make more of it. So if it happens in real estate, people start buying more of it. People start producing more houses. And then the price of houses comes crashing down. If it happens in a metal, that's also the case. Gold is the thing that comes closest to resisting this, but even gold continues to increase at increasing quantities. Every year we find more gold than the year before, or at least, you know, than the three last years. You know, the average continues to go up. It may drop from a year to the other, but every year there's more gold being produced. In the long run, the quantity just goes up. But with Bitcoin, we just get less and less Bitcoin being produced, fewer coins being mined. And so it's amazing if you think about it, how this works and how this bubble just continues to grow, essentially, because there is, you can't think of it as a bubble because there's no way for anybody to make more of it. There's no way for anybody to devalue the holdings of the people that are holding the coins that exist. And it's amazing because every 10 minutes in the network's history in Bitcoin, everybody came to consensus on the number of coins that exist and the ownership of the coins. There's not been any dispute about this stuff in 10, 11 years of operation. And it's amazing in light of the second point we wanted to discuss today, which is, you know, how Bitcoin allows us to just tally money so well all over the world and look at all of these balances for the system where we know exactly how many coins there are. And if you compare it on the other hand to the system for elections that you have in the democracy of the United States and just what an enormous mess it is right now. It's been a couple of days since the vote happened and it's not entirely clear what's going to happen and how things are going to unfold. I don't intend to get political in this other than to just say Hoppe was right. Democracy is a god that failed. And if you pin your hopes on democracy, you know, bad things happen. Because And you know, to compare having a system, having a government system that's built on a democracy that has so much trouble in tallying something so simple as votes, imagining that having to be in charge of something as complex as a monetary system is absolutely, I think, eye-opening. And an example of why really the modern model of democracy has failed in so many ways, because it is, in a sense, almost it flies against economic reality by trying to impose behavior on society based on what the majority thinks and wants, whereas the natural order of monarchies is, you know, in that kind of world, the kings generally have far less of a concern with what it is that other people are doing and trying to impose it on them. And so it continues to surprise me just how much more you can get disillusioned with politics as usual. And you know, I think if you're disillusioned with what's going on in the US, I invite you to go back to our I think it was the first podcast seminar, and the I think it was the ninth or the eighth with so the first one was me discussing democracy and monarchy, and then the second one, the ninth or eighth one, was me and debating Alex Gladstein, moderated by Stefan Levera, discussing the failures of democracy and monarchy. So if you need more reasons to get to feel down on democracy, I recommend these. Anybody have anything to add on NGU Tech and democracy? Anybody from the attendees? Yeah, Tim?
Just wanted to say congratulations, really. if you're an owner of Bitcoin, NGO technology is something that's affecting you right now.
Yes, and you know, if you bought the book and you bought Bitcoin, you bought the book, you know, you're welcome.
I thought you were going to issue an invoice.
Yeah, I think I should start. Somebody was telling me I should start charging, how do you spell it, teeth? You know, prorated per Bitcoin going up. You have to give me part of your Satoshis every time it goes up. But no, I'm magnanimous like that. Just subscribe to my next book. Soon enough, you're going to be getting the opportunity to subscribe to getting weekly emails of chapters from my next two books, The Fiat Standard and The Principles of Economics. Anybody else?
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddin.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as The Fiat Standard and The Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah, I'd just like to say, Saif, when I interviewed you on the podcast, I asked you about your book and whether it sunk in what you'd done and how you're going to be viewed and this piece of work is going to be viewed in in tens of years or hundreds of years. And you palmed it off as like, I think I was just writing about the plumbing and sewerage works or something. So yeah, time to step out of the modest shell, man. And, you know, thanks.
Oh, well, thank you, man. But yeah, I mean, still, NGU technology needs no man. It doesn't need me. And it's all going according to Satoshi's schedule and plan. I may have helped... I may have helped people get it, but you know, still, it's still an incredible thing that works on its own, and nobody can take credit for it. I say, but thank you anyway, Daniel. Appreciate it.
Regarding NGU technology, do you know the phrase "the money is the bubble that never burst"?
Yes.
Do you think it's a good description of the kind of dynamic we are witnessing right now with Bitcoin beating every fiat currency in the world and starting being priced as a monetary alternative?
Yes, absolutely, actually. That's really a very good way of thinking about it, in a sense. I mean, clearly Bitcoin as a bubble has burst many, many times. You know, we went to 19,000 and then all the way down to 3,000. But the difference between Bitcoin and other bubbles is that, you know, when the bubble bursts, we end up down at 3,000, which is still three or something like 5 or 10 times higher than where it was 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago or something like that. And so, you know, even when it bursts, it comes down to a much higher level than where it was before. And that's really the difference between it and other monetary technologies, if you want, or any kind of other bubble. So if you have a bubble in housing, then, you know, the price of housing can go up and then the price of housing can come crashing down. It'll come crashing down somewhere in the range of where it was before it went up. Maybe it'll be 10% higher, maybe 10% lower, maybe it'll be 30% higher, 50% higher, but it won't be 500% higher, you know? It won't be 10 times higher and then go and do another 10 time after that. You know, a few years later, still have another bigger bubble and then have another bigger crash downward and still end up, you know, at a much higher level than where it was before, which is what Bitcoin has done. You have seen several of these crashes. So, and ultimately, I think this really helps understand the point that I was making earlier about a difficulty adjustment, is that Bitcoin essentially is the bubble that never bursts because there's never a way of making more Bitcoin. All the other bubbles eventually burst because there's another way of making more of that stuff that will eventually, the supply will overtake the new demand. Eventually, you can make enough copper to flood everybody with copper. Eventually, you can make enough houses so that, you know, the price of houses goes back down. You can always make more of these things, you know, but with Bitcoin, you just can't make more. There won't be. And so when the price comes crashing down, it still crashes down at a much higher level than where it was earlier. And I think a good way of thinking about it is thinking about the daily mining spend of the daily economic value of the new mining that comes out. So today we've got the price of Bitcoin, or it's at $15,000, and we have, I think it's 900 coins a day now. Yeah. So it's at $15,000 and 900 coins every day. So every day you're getting, what's 9 times 15?
14 million.
13.5 million dollars worth of Bitcoin every day being mined and being thrown onto the market. So if you calculate what it was last year, or 4 years ago, let's say, then it was probably, what was the price around 4 years ago? I think the interesting thing is to look between halving cycles. This is some math that I was running the other day, and I should probably write it up. If you look between halving cycles, you look at the average cost of Bitcoin's mined average price of Bitcoins, average value of the total, average market value of the total Bitcoin mined every day, and then have the average daily value for all of the 4-year period between the two halvings, or 3 years and 10 months or whatever. So from July 2016 to May 2020, that's 3 years and 10 months, the average price and the average value of Bitcoins mined around that time was around, I think, $7,000, $7,500. So on average, during those 4 years, roughly the new demand that was coming in was equal to the amount of money that was coming in at all of these prices. You know, every day we were increasing the Bitcoin supply by that much, and the price was adjusting based on how much new money was coming in. If you calculate the average, it comes to around 7,000. I think that was the price, the average price. I think it was $7,000 or $8,000 or something like that for the entire year period, multiplied by the number of Bitcoins being produced at that time, which was 18,000. So for 4 years, we were sucking up around $8,000 worth of 8,000 times 1,800, which is around around $16 million, I think. That's roughly the average. So for the last 4 years, it was around $16 million that was being pumped into the Bitcoin economy every day. If we manage to pull that off for 4 years, if the next 4 years we continue at around that same level of money coming in, well, now we have 900 coins, right? So in order for that same level to be there, the average price for the 4 years needs to be more like $16,000. So assuming that the demand for Bitcoin in the 4 years after the next after the last halving, in other words, if the demand for Bitcoin from July 2020 until the next halving, which is probably going to be around, say, May 2020, from May 2020 until, March 2024, in those 4 years, if demand for Bitcoin stays the same, likely the average price for Bitcoin is going to be somewhere around $8,000. Sorry, $16,000. The average price will be somewhere around $16,000. Right. If the demand, if the daily demand for Bitcoin is similar to what it was in the previous years, you would expect the price to double. But of course, it doesn't just double. As we've seen over the last few cycles, it more than doubles, because the fact that it doubles and it doesn't crash down wakes a lot of people up to the fact that, hang on a second, this is real NGU technology right here. This is really number go up in a way that we've not seen before. Because And this is, you know, this is, I remember what happened with me. Like, initially I thought, oh, well, that's a nifty, nice idea. You know, once it crashes down a few times and is destroyed a few times and then rises again, maybe it would be worth putting some money into it. But then you witness the price going from, you know, $1 to $10 to $100. And yeah, it comes crashing down, but it crashes down, it's still much higher. And then you get it that, okay, this thing is... There's something different about the way that this market asset functions. So nothing crashes, nothing rises so fast. And so, and nothing, you know, if you think about it, it's a little piece of code on the internet, and it's obscure who runs it, and nobody knows who controls it, and nobody knows, you know, I'm thinking of the noob who hears about it for the first time, you know, who are the people behind Bitcoin? Who runs it? Who's responsible for it? Is it redeemable? All of these questions that spring up, and yet all of them are just potential red flags for why you shouldn't be looking into Bitcoin. And yet NGU keeps going, and NGU keeps working. And so, and then you check again 2 years later, and it's 10 times the price that you checked where it was the last time. And so you start thinking, you know, if this was such a scam, how is it working out so well? How are they managing to keep the price going? So then that in its own, the fact that it can just double in price, that in its own is going to attract a lot more attention, a lot more people to speculate. And so that's going to take the price potentially even higher, I would say. But, you know, again, I don't give investment advice, and you're on your own. You have to make your own mind up and make your own decisions. And I don't take any responsibility for anything anybody says. Anybody does based on what they hear here, you know. And I'm here to just think loudly as a seminar. You make your own decisions in life. Don't drag me into your bad decisions, basically. That's how I would think about it. I should always remember to put these disclaimers, I guess, just in case people get too excited and then get wrecked. So we never know, you know. Bitcoin's always very volatile, so don't blame me if bad things happen. But I think ultimately this is what it comes down to. You know, there's, I think a lot of people believe in the efficient market hypothesis and think that it is some kind of really profound insight about markets. But I think from the Austrian perspective, you know, knowledge on the market is not something that is just out there for everybody to know. People have to discover it, and it takes time to discover it, and it takes time for people to understand what is going on. And the vast majority of people don't know what Bitcoin is, and they don't understand it, and they you know, they're learning the hard way. Everybody has to learn some way. So ultimately, that kind of thinking of the efficient market hypothesis, the idea that, well, if that knowledge is public, then everybody knows it and all market participants know it, ignores the brutal realities of economics, which people today seem to ignore because they just think economics is about models and math and theories and things that get published in academic journals. But I mean, the simplest, most basic concept in economics is supply and demand. And, you know, no matter what people think about the price and what the price is going to be doing in the future, there's you know, 13, 15, 14 or $10 million worth of Bitcoin being produced every day, roughly, over the last few years, that need to find somebody to buy them and hold them and, you know, provide them a loving, caring home in a huddle stash somewhere in order for NGU technology to work. Like, you know, NGU does not work if people don't hold Bitcoin. We can't just all want Bitcoin to rise and all think that Bitcoin will rise in order for it to go up. We have to actually, you know, take resources away from other things and put them into holding Bitcoin. I think this is really the key thing to keep in mind, and that has an opportunity cost. And so, even though I think, you know, even though people might know and think that Bitcoin is going to go up, they can't arbitrage it away because they need to eat, because they need to have a home to sleep in, and they need to have all kinds of things that they spend money on, and they need to factor in for the fact that they may be wrong. And so, you know, there's a limit on how many resources you can bring to bear into holding Bitcoin. And so we need more people to buy Bitcoin and hold it in order for it, in order for the price for it to go up. And so that's the restraint. And the restraint is not just knowing about it, you know, hearing about the halving and hearing about the discounting that's going to happen is not going to, is really not going to be the difference that's going to make make the price go up. It's about people actually taking resources away from other things and putting them into Bitcoin. And that requires sacrifice. It has a real opportunity cost. And so that's really ultimately what the what NGU technology requires for it to work. Anybody else? No. All right.
A question from my side. With companies going in and converting their cash, parts of the cash, like MicroStrategy has done it, yeah, and investing that with their intention to hold it long term, doesn't that result in much less of a dip, really, and much less volatility, because there are more participants really who see this very long term rather than people trying to make short term gains. I mean, if you listen to Michael Saylor, he said he's going to hold it for the next 100 years or whatever. Yeah? So if Square or whatever, if they intended for a longer period, it's taking a lot of parts away, amount of the total away that is not available. It's not available for trade for nothing. It's just kind of you've reduced whatever can be purchased. And if more and more people hold on, and if the weekends are shaken out, I think like that they have been done really, or like it has happened really on the rise up really over the last 6 months probably or more, then I think I would expect at least not to see the same kind of drop, even percentage-wise, not only down to a certain amount, a lesser amount of what is, will only go up down to $5,000 or whatever. But percentage-wise, that we do not see 80% drops, maybe just only 30, 40, 50% drops at a maximum.
Potentially, but I mean, the thing is, you know, you have to remember that the bigger the rise, the bigger the crash almost. That's kind of always going to be the case. At the end of the day, when a lot of over-leveraged people are in and then not enough money is coming in, and then, you know, when the price rises a lot of the holders will start selling more and more. When that happens, you know, we can overtake the new extra demand coming in from speculators, and then the crash comes in, and then people are over-leveraged, so then you get cascades of liquidations, and then you get a much bigger crash, and it's harder to go and sustain the much higher price levels. At the end of the day, you know, okay, there was that initial supply shock, but there's the initial supply shock, which would, you would expect that would give the price double, would make the price double. But then there's the secondary supply shock, which is that holders will start selling. And that's eventually going to just continue to be the case, I think. Now, as long as Bitcoin is still very early in its adoption, as long as we still have a very small number, you know, when people can talk about not selling and joke about it as much as they want, but really, ultimately, you know, the higher the price goes, the more that old holders will have to necessarily sell, just because it becomes insane when, you know, it's much higher than they would expect. They're going to rationally start selling some of it, I think, and that's currently, you know, going to that's going to, I think, lead to, over time, it's going to start reducing the volatility, because the people will start seeing those cycles, recognizing that those cycles happen, and then they'll start understanding when to buy and compared to the cycle. And then the more people can arbitrage the cycle away, the less volatility you get. I think this is really the this is the way it works. On the one hand, just the ability of people to see the cycles and then predict them. And then secondly, just the growing number of people in the network, the more number of people, the bigger the market cap, the harder it is for, you know, individual purchases to make differences in the prices. So I think we can get these bubbles in a much more attenuated way, rather than just these big giant spikes and crashes. We could start moving in a much less, in a much smoother path toward these things.
Actually, regarding this burst phase, what do you think is the impact of credit cycles? Because at the burst of a credit cycle, you could imagine that some people will be over leveraged, and with the price of their assets falling from a cliff, they would have to sell what the only thing they can sell, and in some cases this will be Bitcoin. I think it could be a trigger for the bull market.
I'm sorry, what was the last thing you said? I lost you. You said it could be what?
Excuse me, shitty internet connection. It could be the credit cycle, the bursting of the bubble could also trigger a down cycle in Bitcoin, because of the fact that holders will have to sell their Bitcoin in order to compensate the falling prices of their houses, stock portfolio, and stuff like that?
Yes. So in one of the research papers that we discuss in Course Economics 31, it's the second paper, which is also available on my website on research, safedean.com/research. And if you're listening in a couple of weeks after this is recorded, it should hopefully be in the members area. It should be available for people in the members area. And if it's not, remind me. But in that paper, you know, I think I look at both sides of the argument, and I think it's too early to tell whether with the first business cycle that we see, with the first market crash, that whether Bitcoin will be a safe haven asset or whether it will be an asset that gets liquidated. I would have leaned for saying that, you know, for the first couple of financial crises in Bitcoin's life, it would be likely to, as you said, sell off because it would be a risk on risk off trade. I think what the Corona episode showed us this year is that, you know, when Bitcoin, okay, it did crash, but then it came roaring back, and it's now double where it started in the year. So even with all of the Corona stuff, we're still at 100% return over where we were at the beginning of the year. So, and you know, Bitcoin doesn't have a central bank that can just print and quantitatively ease in order to fix it. We rely on, as we were saying, you know, quantitative hardening, and where instead the halving comes in and cuts the supply of Bitcoin. And, you know, essentially the quantitative easing borrows growth and borrows stock number go up. It borrows an increase in the returns for stockholders from the future by creating more claims on present wealth into the future. So you're borrowing, you're creating more debt in order to make the stock market numbers go up. Whereas with Bitcoin, you know, it's pure equity. There's no borrowing from the future. This is an asset that is being manufactured, and we're just making fewer of it. And so because we're making fewer of it, it's becoming less prevalent on the market, and that's causing the prices to rise. So you know, with what happens with people like Saylor, when I'm more confident now to talk about this stuff now that somebody like Saylor is on board with this message. Because, you know, when it was a bunch of us on Bitcoin Twitter saying it, it really did look ridiculous to think that this would be a safe haven because it's still very small. Now, you know, it's a little bit less ridiculous because you see that people with large companies and serious resources are seeing how it would be the place where you would want to park your wealth in a financial crisis, because everything else is going to get debased one way or the other. All right. Next, I guess we should just, that would segue us into the topic that we wanted to discuss today, on Corona hysteria. I wanted to first mention, on Monday, we're going to start having a second seminar every week, starting this Monday, November 9th. And this is going to be at a time that is more suitable for people in the Far East and in Australia to be able to join us. So it's going to be at Monday on at 8 p.m. Eastern time, Eastern U.S. time, at 8 p.m. And this Monday we're going to be having our guest, the first guest would be Dr. James Todaro, who you may have seen on Twitter. He is into Bitcoin. He's been into Bitcoin for a while, but recently he became pretty famous over the work that he did on hydroxychloroquine as a drug, and he got into some controversy about it, and he has a lot to say about this. So we're going to be discussing this with him on Monday. Today I wanted to go over some of the main
issues and problems that I have had with this entire thing from the beginning. First of all, for me, the main issue was that started ringing off the alarm bells was the World Health Organization being extremely concerned. That was really the major problem for me, because, and for several reasons. First of all, the World Health Organization are basically fiat food peddlers. You go to their website and it's all about all the advantages and wonders and joys of eating industrial food. And it's an organization in which industrial food producers and drug makers have invested a lot over the years, and they get the recommendations that they want. So this organization is always telling the world about how meat is bad for you, and grains and sugars are, well, sugars are okay in moderation or in small quantities. Grains are good. And in particular, you know, the World Health Organization is one of these international organizations who looks at food as an industrial problem that needs to be solved, and thinks of it efficiently from the perspective, and finds that the most efficient way to do it is through plant proteins. And so they don't want you eating meat because meat is expensive. They want you eating soy and lentils and stuff. So they promote that stuff. They promote things like statins, drugs for blood pressure. And this has been shown to be one of the worst things that you can do and take for your body. And a lot of research has been done on just how destructive these things are. But it's the most profitable drug in history. No drug in pharma has made more money than Lipitor. And I'm pretty sure that is the case. And so it's enormously profitable, and there has been an enormous drive to use Lipitor as and statins in general, I think, as the sort of treatment for everybody. As soon as you start getting any kind of problems, you should go on it. And the evidence suggests that it's quite a seriously harmful treatment, and it's doesn't really achieve the goals that it's supposed to achieve. And yet they continue to recommend it. They also recommend formula for babies, and they think that that stuff is good. And of course, the World Health Organization has a massive problem that I'd heard about previously on in terms of the incentive structure, which encourages them to always overstate the threat from any likely disease to happen. And that's an enormously important point that people forgot about, which I couldn't forget about early, because I had been aware of this. Because if you follow the news, you know, people who follow the news have a very short attention span, so they don't keep track of these stories when they come and go. And you know, when the story is on the front page, when the story is in on the news, you're thinking all day about it. And then when it's off the front page, you don't follow up and you don't see what has happened, but you're still left with the initial impression of terror and horror that you got when you were watching the TV. So if you look at something like let's say in 2003 it was SARS, and then in 2010 it was swine flu. And in both those cases, you know, you get to this point where the World Health Organization announces that we have an outbreak of something somewhere. And then you start getting diagnoses from all over the world of people saying, all right, somebody's getting it here and somebody's getting it there. And supposedly this is just going to continue to take off, and everybody's concerned and everybody is frightened. And then at the end, what used to happen with these outbreaks, SARS and so on, is that, you know, there's a lot of hysteria in the media when the thing is going on. And then afterwards, if you actually look back, you see that the number of people who died is no different from the number of people who die from respiratory infections every year. It's just how the world works. Every year we get people who get sick with respiratory diseases, and many of them die all over the world. This happens. So
you know, they have a strong incentive to overstate the threat and a strong incentive to always present the ordinary as being extraordinary. You know, every new cold is going to be the Hollywood blockbuster epidemic that you have been watching in Hollywood for so many years, but that just continues to fail to materialize. So SARS, Ebola, all of these, there was the Hong Kong, and then there was the MERS, and there was, and all of these, I think the Hong Kong virus was a very old one in the 60s. But no, the recent ones, every 4 or 5 years, you know, you get a bad flu season and you get this massive hysteria by the World Health Organization about the fact that this is going to start leading to massive outbreaks. Because, you know, if your job is to detect outbreaks, you don't want to be the guy who is going to be blamed for not reporting. So you have an incentive to always overstate the risk, because you want to err on the side of, you know, it wasn't as bad as we expected, because then it's not your fault. It might not be the optimal strategy that you would choose for other people, but, you know, you prefer to just not be the one who's getting blamed for it. And this, we see this stuff has happened as well with animals. There's all these outbreaks that happen to animals. You know, a couple of cows are sick in one farm, and then a couple of cows in a farm that's close by are sick with similar symptoms. And then people freak out, health agency will freak out and say, oh, we have an outbreak of something. And then they'll slaughter 50,000 cows in the entire region. And this has been quite common. It's in England in particular, they do this. Neil Ferguson, we're going to be seeing him in the modeling stuff we're going to be discussing soon. Neil Ferguson also participated in many of these mass cullings of farm animals over the past 10, 20 years. He'd make a model and he'd say, you know, this is going to kill 50 million people. And so in order to stop it, we need to massacre this. So this is something that I'd always had in the back of my mind when the whole hysteria began to happen around coronavirus back in January. And so I was highly skeptical of the idea that this was really the extra dangerous killer that is going to destroy the planet over the next few months. I couldn't buy that. I couldn't just buy the idea that it would be so dangerous, because in my mind, I thought the people who you can't but help but judge the source that comes to you. And the source is somebody who has a very strong incentive that, to overstate threats, and that is massively compromised. So I'm not going to go around and ruin my life based on the word of somebody that I know is an established liar. So that was the first thing. The second major red light that rang for me was the famous and infamous now exponentials. Just this hysteria around the word exponential. And the modeling there was a massive red flag for me, because, you know, having come from Austrian economics, from a background of having read Hayek and Mises and Rothbard, and thought about these questions quite deeply in the context of economics, I could see very easily, very transparently, how the same stupid mistakes that macroeconomists do are being done in these stupid epidemiological models. And so the idea, ultimately, it's if you've taken Economics 11, and I highly recommend you take that course, from the Austrian perspective, the way toward understanding economic and social phenomena is to look through the lens of the human action. It is humans that act. Humans are the agents of change in the world. Humans are what turn dead matter into economic resources and give this dead matter value. You have to understand things through what humans are doing. And if you do that,
you understand that humans have agency and humans act, and you cannot just aggregate away all of the action of all of the humans in the world and treat it as if it is irrelevant to forces that you are privy to because you have good mathematical models. This is the stuff that makes me angry at some point, to some level, because it's such a common mistake in all of the pseudosciences that are taught at universities today. And it's absolutely devastating the impact that it has had in terms of economics and in terms of epidemiology, because epidemiology is, you know, it's essentially a pseudoscience. It is a pseudoscience. It's a very stupid pseudoscience because it's built on this idea that what's going to happen with diseases depends on what people, depends on these numbers that are properties of the virus, that are properties of this illness. And, you know, we are just helpless cattle, essentially, where diseases come and infect us and destroy us according to mathematical formula. And so, you know, we look at, and this is how the early dumb epidemiology science was done in this whole ordeal. They'd look at a bunch of airplanes coming out of Wuhan, and they would look at how many people were sick, and then they would look at how many of those people died, and then they would estimate from that and then extrapolate to the entire world population. That's exactly how dumb it is. Like, you know, the sample of 100 people on an airplane or is essentially treated as if it is a predictive and a statistically significant enough sample that you can make a predictive model from it to generalize onto the whole planet. And that's absurd. I mean, if you look at the models where they do the you look at the polling for the elections, it was off massively. Regardless of whoever wins, you know, the polls and the experts and the models were completely off. They were predicting a Biden landslide in so many of the states, and yet it's very clear that they're pretty close pretty much everywhere. Well, not everywhere, they're not close everywhere, but it's still it's still a much closer race than they predicted. And these polls are conducted by professional agencies that have been trying to poll and sample Americans all over the country for God knows how many months. And what do they come up with? They come up with predictive models that don't work. Now imagine what epidemiologists do, essentially. You know, if you ignore the fake lab coats that they wear on their Twitter profiles, they're just running a bunch of stupid mathematical models where they just essentially take the samples and assume that the sample of the airplane leaving Wuhan can give us an accurate, you know, this would reflect an underlying reality about the universe, how the universe works, and that will then translate everywhere else in the world. It's an underlying reality of how the virus is functions, and you know, if it happened on that airplane, it has to happen everywhere else in the world. If 3% of the people on the airplane died, then 3% of the people on the entire planet are going to be dying. That was really the idiotic way in which epidemiologists works. And you know, a lot of people who usually would be smarter than believing in this garbage end up falling for it anyway, because, you know, once people start getting scared, their brain stops working and their you know, their idiot takes over, basically. And so it starts, you know, the notion that epidemiology has uncovered anything about how the world actually works is ridiculous. All that it is doing is that it's estimating averages and then trying to pretend that you can extrapolate onto billions of people in the world. It ignores the element of human agency, and it ignores the element of human individuality. All humans are not the same. You can't treat a population of a country as just one blob where, you know, oh, 3% of those people are going to be dying, or, you know, 20% are going to be in the hospital and 3% will die. And that's just the number. Well, what if people are different? What if the people who were on that airplane were slightly unhealthy for whatever reason? What if there was, you know, some holiday, something, and a lot of grandparents were flying on that flight, and so it happened to have a lot of old people? That's maybe what the answer was. And, you know, maybe people on that airplane were dying from all other kinds of reasons. You cannot just extrapolate to the entire planet, and you cannot ignore the individual aspect of health. And that's really the thing that ultimately makes me highly skeptical of this entire approach, this totalitarian approach to health, is that health is individual. And the notion that you can just, you're going to scare people. People who get scared from the fact that this virus is going to kill us are people who don't have charge of their own health, who don't control their own health, don't understand how their body works, and they don't realize that they can, in fact, be in charge of their own health. And that illness is not something that just comes and attacks the body. You know, as we see now, if you look at the studies and the data on the people who have succumbed to this illness, the vast majority of them had a very low life expectancy anyway. They were very old or they were very sick. So it's been a year now that the virus has been spreading all over the world, and we don't have a single place, I think an example of anywhere, where these this virus just went through a population and killed healthy, normal people that were just doing fine. We don't see that. We see very small number of people dying, and usually those people are people who are very weak. And so this kind of epidemiological modeling for me was absolutely insane, because of just how ridiculous it would be to assume that humans are just indifferent, you know, no different from one another, and it's just a virus that's going to, you know, decimate human population based on some ridiculous formula. And so all of these epidemiological numbers that everybody became an expert on, you know, the fatality rate, the R0, the case fatality rate, the infant, the infection fatality rate, blah, 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 blah. All of that stuff is garbage. All of that stuff is nonsense. All of these numbers are worthless, pointless, idiotic nonsense. Anybody who spends time trying to figure out what these numbers are is just wasting their time in something completely useless. Diseases don't come pre-programmed. It's such a computer way of thinking of things. Like it's not a piece of software. It's not Bitcoin. We don't have a supply of Bitcoins that's going to be produced, and we don't have a supply of virus that is going to be produced every day. It doesn't work that way. If somebody is sick, they could catch it and they could do badly. If somebody's not sick, then it's become quite clear that this isn't devastating. This isn't a black plague. This isn't going to kill a third of Europe. It's not that devastating. It's been a year and it's been spreading all over the world, and we've seen many places where it has been spreading. And it doesn't really work. These numbers mean nothing. Like, can somebody actually now answer the question, what is the R0 for this disease? Well, and it's, you know, it, of course, the way that they use it, the governments use it, is that they treat it as if it is something that they control, and that it is something that is responding to their measures. And that's really, I think, the really absolutely ridiculous thing about it. And of course, you know, the way that this has driven the hysteria is because of this enormous incentive that these health organizations have at not being the ones who were caught napping and didn't sound the alarm. They don't want to go down the history books as, you know, the person who saw the next epidemic and thought, nah, it'll be all right, and then didn't tell people to take precaution. Because of this, they're always focusing on the worst case scenario, and they're always focusing the news in a way that makes it the scariest possible. And so initially, when the number of people dying was higher, you know, there weren't a lot of tests, and there weren't a lot of people getting tested for it. And so the only people who were getting tested were the people who were dying or were very sick. And so naturally, you would find a very high fatality rate amongst there. And so, of course, the idiot epidemiologists would then go and extrapolate that to the entire population. And, you know, if you, very few people were able to point this out in March, even though, you know, it's amazing, like, how many people just make it a hobby to always find problems with statistics and data and to pinpoint problems with statistical models. And yet somebody makes this magically idiotic mistake of looking at a study in Italy that measures the fatality rate amongst people who are essentially all over 70 and then generalizes that all over the world. People thought that that was normal. And I was pointing this out on my Twitter back in March. And, you know, I still don't see any good explanation for why you would generalize that or why you would take the death rate of one particular group of people in a particular hospital as being somehow a programmable constant that's going to infect everything in the world. And now that testing is so widespread, we don't hear anything about the fatality rate anymore because that's not scary anymore. Now it's 0.00009% or whatever. But we're hearing all these things about infections, which is just how many positive tests turn up in the fatality, how many positive tests turn up. And of course, the infection numbers continuously go up because the number of tests is continuously going up and the number of people taking tests is continuously going up. And because this test, the PCR test, is essentially, you know, it is highly likely to produce a lot of positive, false positives, because its entire calibration depends on the threshold for the number of cycles of amplification that you do. And effectively, this test is really not a test to detect things. It's a test to it's not a test to detect quantities of things, because what the test does is that it amplifies the molecular matter that exists of anything. And with every cycle of amplification, it amplifies its presence. And so the more cycles you amplify, the more significant the result of the test will be, and the more likely you are to get an infection, I mean, to get a positive result. And so basically, any PCR test that runs over 35 cycles is going to have a very high chance of having a false positive. Arguably, some would even say that there's no such a thing as a true positive with a PCR test. Some people would even say that the entire notion of using this test for this virus makes no sense. And one of these people is the actual inventor of the PCR test, Carrie Mullis. He himself says, you know, this doesn't really work. So he explains that, you know, this test will find the smallest trace of a molecule and then amplify it. And so it can allow you to find anything in anything, as he says it. It's not something that you can use to detect disease. That's, I think, the key point. And what's happening now is that the world is confusing a PCR test, a positive PCR test, with illness. And this became clear in the last couple of weeks after Cristiano Ronaldo, the Juventus and Portugal forward, one of the best football players in the world. He's been at the top of the professional game for, I think, about 18 years now. And he's won everything there is to be won, except the World Cup. I'm sure that bothers him. But it's going to be hard to win that with Portugal. But he's won an enormous amount of stuff. He's one of the most incredible athletes. I follow football. I know. I mean, the amount of discipline that he has had in his career is incredible. He's been at the top of the game since the age of 17. And he's now, I think, 35, 36, maybe 37 even. Something like that. So it's incredible about his ability to take care of his health is truly impeccable. He's in his mid-30s now, and he's, you know, players his age have usually retired by this time, but he's still at the top of the game, scoring in the Champions League and in the Italian League. So he definitely knows something about how to be healthy. And he had three PCR tests, and they all turned up positive. And he's in good enough shape to play professional football. And it's happened with a lot of athletes in football and in other sports. They're in good enough shape to turn up to training and to play 90 minutes. But somehow the test says they're positive, so they have to stay home and quarantine for 2 weeks. And this is just becoming increasingly absurd with time. I think more and more people hopefully will notice. So these are all different problems I've had with the hysteria.
But what do you guys think? I should probably take a little break and let you guys speak a bit. Anything you want to add?
I am wondering how you feel about the long-term effects. You do hear conversations about that.
Yeah, I think the long-term effects, you mean the health effects or the economic effects?
No, the long-term health effects on organs of the body.
Yeah. I mean, I don't particularly know all that much about it, but I think the incredible thing about the framing of this issue is that, you know, when somebody says, well, I don't think we should lock people up at home, and then people will bring up, well, this disease causes long-term effects. I don't know enough about that, but, you know, even if it does, that doesn't change anything about the fact that these measures are not effective. And it doesn't change anything about the fact that the diseases that cause long-term effects have always existed and will always continue to exist and will always continue to cause this kind of damage. So there's nothing unique about it that is different. You know, we've always had people getting sick and getting ill. And framing it in this way presents it as if, you know, if you want to get on with your life, if you don't think that people should be forced to stay home, then you support the disease and you support other people dying and you support illness. And I think it's just, it's a terrible framing, because in reality, you know, no, I support living. I support the idea that there's a small number of, there's a limited amount of time that we have on Earth. And precisely because life can be dangerous and death can come at any time, precisely because of that, you want to be out, yeah, living your life. Peter, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I just had a quick question on what you were saying about respiratory disease deaths in the conversation. So I just wanted to check, is it the case that this year there hasn't been any sort of abnormal increase in respiratory disease deaths? Is that your understanding of the data?
Ultimately, every year there's around 3 million deaths from pneumonia all over the world, and there's about 1 million deaths from influenza, and there's about another 5-6 million deaths from other kinds of diseases of the respiratory system. And I've tweeted somewhere about this. I'll include it here. A report on it's the International Association of something related to respiratory deaths. So effectively, they find that there's about 10.5 million deaths related to respiratory. They say deaths of respiratory diseases. I think the year 2020 has taught us about the difference between deaths with and deaths of or from. So let's say that what they're saying is that there's about 10.5 million diseases, 10 million deaths every year. And there's about 60 million deaths overall. So every year, 60 million people die just because humans aren't immortal. So about 10-15% of that is related to respiratory diseases, between pneumonia, asthma, influenza, all other kinds of respiratory diseases. So, and here we've had one whole year of coronavirus, and we still see that, you know, the total number, I think at this point, stands at around 1.2 million. So 1.2 million, and also we know how much more of a financial incentive there is for people in medical industry to get into to report corona deaths versus other deaths, and how much there is an incentive for that. And, you know, essentially, when you keep that in mind, you see that really, so we have 1 million deaths, and out of 10 million who die with respiratory illnesses every year. If you gave those 10 million a PCR test any year, whatever test you do, you're going to get some result for some kind of virus. You know, every year there are millions and trillions of virus out there, and the PCR test will turn positive on a fraction of them. And so if you gave the same PCR test looking for a different virus last year, you would have probably found out of those 10 million, you would have found a million who would have turned up positive. And so now we have a million deaths that year. So I think this is the thing that people miss, in that, you know, it's not like the, of course people are dying, but people are always dying, A, and B, it's not like if there was anything different, you know, people would just end up living forever. The same people would end up having to die. And the notion that we can just play God and, you know, switch off society and then that will extend the lifespan of everybody is just ridiculous. There's absolutely no evidence that it works, of course. And we've seen, after many months, we've seen many examples of just, you know, they lock down and deaths go up. And then we see countries that didn't lock down and we didn't see deaths. So on the one hand, we see on a global level, we see this number. And then on the important way that I would answer this is to look at, on the country level, look at Belarus. That's my favorite example. Or Sweden. In that the total number of people dying in Sweden this year is no different from what it usually is. It's, in fact, in September, it became clear, this last September in Sweden had the lowest number of deaths ever, or the lowest percentage of deaths, I think, ever in Swedish history.
Really?
Yeah. And in a sense, this is, you know, maybe it was a very bad flu that took away the life, it took away people who would have been dying now just out of old age. You know, the people who would have died in a hospice or in an old retirement home in September this year, instead of dying in September, they ended up dying in March. That's ultimately what changed. Because you look at the total number of people dying in Sweden, it's no different from what it has always been. And so, you know, what difference does this make? And then, of course, they'll show you, well, Sweden has more deaths than its neighbors. And of course, if you plot it against its neighbors, it's, oh, look, Sweden is so much higher. Well, no, it's not so much. If you look at it, it's just all of the numbers are within the normal range of what happens with respiratory deaths in all countries in all the years. And having said that, there is a major problem with the Swedish approach. I think I'm more of a Belarus fan than Sweden. I think Sweden definitely disproves the idea that you need lockdowns. It's a good example. But the problem with Sweden is that, you know, their chief epidemiologist, the guy that everybody hails as a hero, I don't see him much of a hero, because after all, he is still an epidemiologist, which, you know, means he chose this as a career path, which means, you know, you can't expect much cognitively. But he did the very, very, very stupid thing that most state epidemiologists and public health officials, well, not most, but many did, which is that they thought, oh no, that's now going to overwhelm all of our hospitals. So let's send all the sick old people to the elderly homes and lock the elderly homes up. And that's why they had such a high rate. So what happened in Sweden is that essentially they made the same mistake they made in Quebec and in New York and in New Jersey and in many states, where they sent sick people to elderly nursing homes. And these caused infections that caused a lot of deaths. And so, you know, it's not like Sweden is a paragon to follow in that regard. I think, and it's another example of how the hysteria has killed a lot, and how the case. It's another. You can add this to the. You can add this to the score for the hysterics, because that's really. It's really, you know, a lot of these deaths wouldn't have happened if people hadn't freaked out. Hospitals would have continued normally. They wouldn't have sent their elderly to nursing homes. And, you know, maybe some hospitals would have been overloaded. Maybe they would have built field hospitals. And maybe we would have ended up with far fewer deaths, because the places where they didn't send their elderly sick to the nursing homes didn't get as many deaths. But ultimately, that number that people bandy about, oh, Sweden is higher than Denmark, Sweden is higher than Finland, that's just a tiny, in the grand scheme of things, it's a rounding error in the total number of deaths that happen in Sweden. And to be frank, it's a rounding error in the life expectancy of those of most of those people who died, because most of the people who died were in very bad shape and were very old. But most importantly, it's irrelevant to the lockdown debate. You know, whether you should send sick people to nursing homes to save the hospitals, or whether you should not send them and keep them in the hospitals, is irrelevant to whether you want you want to have the lockdown or you want to restrict people's movements. I think that's really the key point.
Yeah. AJ? I think it will be interesting. Just going to say quickly, I think it'd be interesting to see at the end of the full year what the global population statistics are like. So I, inspired by the Paul Ehrlich, Julian Simon bet that was put on, I put on a bet with someone who was super worried about the virus in February. And I said, he was saying that he thinks the global population is going to fall and that's going to result in a big economic impact. And I said, if there's any sort of meaningful deviation of the global population growth, I think it's growing at the moment about 0.8%, 0.9%, something like that, maybe about 1%. I said, if there's any sort of meaningful diversion from that trend, then he wins the bet. Then he wins the bet. And if not, I win the bet. And it looks like there's going to be virtually no change in overall global population, but that will be very interesting to see once we've been through the full seasons, so we can get all the seasonal variations bumped out, actually what has happened to the global population.
Yeah, I mean, by the most inflated measures of the corona hysterics, we have 1.2 million deaths. And that's naturally a rounding error over the total number of deaths that's going to be. The last year for which I think we have reliable statistics is 2017, I think, or 2016. And it was 56 million deaths back then. So, 2020, in a few years, we should get the numbers. It should be somewhere around that. But I think it's really, really sad to say it, but I think we might witness more mortality in 2021. And it won't have anything to do with the virus. It'll maybe even in 2020, we'll see a lot more mortality coming from the virus. But I think 2021 might be even more. I think you might end up losing the bet, because we realize a lot more people are dying from malaria and from tuberculosis and from cancer and from diabetes and obesity and depression and suicide and all these other causes of death than would be happening otherwise, not because of the virus, but because of the hysteria surrounding the virus. So this might be the concern. Having said that, although there's the other flip side, which is car accidents, our deaths are going to be much lower, and workplace accident deaths are going to be much lower since nobody is working anymore. So it's, nobody can really tell. And that's exactly why you don't mess with this stuff. That's exactly why the Austrians say you just let people have freedom. Because this notion that the idiots who watch CNN are going to figure out how we can, pass policies that are going to save lives are just so conceited and so ridiculous, so suffering so much from the conceit of knowledge. That is just ridiculous. You can't dictate how many people are going to be dying, and if you restrict people's freedom in one way, you're not going to just save them from all causes of death. You're restricting their freedom in one way, and you're making it harder for them to avoid all the other causes of death, because really, far more people in the world are dying from metabolic syndrome and all of the associated illnesses that come with that, diabetes and cancer and heart disease. All of these things are killing so many people needlessly who could get so many more years of life if they would be able to take care of their health. if you really want to save lives, you know, you should be taking fiat food, kicking it out of people's hands and putting taxes on fiat food and banning fiat food rather than making people stay home. You know, I mean, it's just so absurd, the idea that we can control the spread of a virus and that it would stop death when we're not even mentioning what we do for what people should be doing for their own health is just so ridiculous. The notion that the World Health Organization is out there telling people to wear muzzles and to hide in their basement, but mentioning nothing about, you know, maybe get some sunshine, maybe get some food, maybe get, you know, eat actual food, don't eat industrial waste. No. Nobody cares about that. It's ridiculous.
And do you think the school system has a part to play in that, in the sense that a lot of people are agreeing to stay home and to go full lockdown, and they believe in the crazy story that the government will protect them? And I was thinking that maybe many, many years ago, when people were more independent in their thought and action, this couldn't happen, while now a lot of what we are doing in school and also in corporate environment is just follow in order to earn points or salary, but with no risk taking, no independent thinking, no thinking about stuff like that.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you were cutting off a bit, and I got the gist of the question. I think so. I think public education is doing a massive disservice to people. It's amazing how, you know, the way that education functions is that it teaches people to, it teaches people that, you know, once you've been able to recite the story that is told to you about why certain things happen in a certain way, then that thing is true. So my favorite example of this is all of the, you know, if you go back to March and February, think about all the bleating chorus of idiots, you know, who were shouting at you for not agreeing with them and going along, and you're being harassed and being called a grandma killer. And ultimately, if you remember how these idiots would talk, it would specifically be about, you know, you don't understand, we have to flatten the curve. We don't understand, the curve is exponential and we have to flatten it. And it's amazing, like, people are taught these things which they listen to because they're afraid, and because they're in a state of fear, they turn into idiots, and they're extremely receptive to having their minds shaped and molded. And so they think that, you know, I'm afraid somebody has an elaborate story about exponentials and that the curve has to go up. And so if we break it down, obviously it makes sense. We'll flatten it. We all stay home and then it won't spread. And then it will spread much slower. Like, how much, how little critical thinking do you have to, sorry, can you guys unmute please? How much critical thinking do you have in order to, how much lack of critical thinking do you have in order to be able to ignore all of the logical holes in this idea? Most obvious, obviously, is, you know, why should this disease follow an exponential curve? Why should it follow the exponent at all? Why do you extrapolate from one neighborhood or one hospital or 10 hospitals to the entire world's population? Public education, I think, it doesn't teach you to think. It doesn't teach you many useful skills. What? Not just public education, in fact, more and more education in general, it's producing a generation of people that, for whom, you know, their cognitive function is being able to repeat this story is evidence enough that it is true. Like, if I just get the fact, I understand the fact that, oh, we flatten the curve, we are going to remove the exponential, I cannot have any kind of critical thinking where I get into it, because, you know, the science says, the scientists from Imperial College made the simulation and made the model. And the science says that this this curve is going to be exponential. And so, you know, obviously we have to listen to the science. This is effectively what education is creating. And it's, I would have thought, I think my feeling until 2019, my belief until 2019 was that this is declining because of the internet, that up until, you know, this peaked in 2000, in the 1980s, when there were few TV stations and everybody had to watch TV. And then in the 80s, TV becomes much more diverse, and then you get satellite, and so everybody can watch their own thing, and then you get internet, and now everybody is fractioned away in this. So you'd think this kind of herd mentality would get weaker and weaker, and I thought, you know, social media would help that. And then 2020 comes along and just slaps all of that in the face and says, nope, people are just getting easier to herd. And in fact, social media ended up being massively useful at this, like Twitter and Facebook. Well, Twitter was the best of them, to be fair. But Facebook and YouTube in particular did an enormously powerful job in herding people all over the world toward the scientific view of essentially World Health Organization bureaucrats who want to scare you as much as you can, as they can. I think one thing that comes to me, that occurs to me, is that basically the more that any institution is affected by the corona hysterics, the more you should really be you should be skeptical about the fact that you need this in the first place. And so, you know, I'd already had a lot of misgivings about schools. And I'd always thought, you know, homeschooling is probably a better choice than going to school. And now that you see, as schools, well, not all schools, but, you know, most schools are just becoming completely insane, making 7-year-old kids wear masks during soccer practice and making kids wear masks and unable to talk to each other and putting them in cages and in behind plexiglass and just destroying the entire experience of childhood, you see that, you know, well, maybe that place wasn't the best place for your child in the first place. Like, if this place, if this place will prioritize the orders of public health bureaucrats over the well-being and happiness of your child, maybe that place was not the best place for your child in the first place. And so, you know, the fact that schools and universities have been at the forefront of the hysteria is sad, but at the same time, it's kind of fitting because, they're ruining themselves and they're ruining their own finances. And that's going to cause a lot of problems for them and a lot of problems for the people who trust in them and who are spending money on them. And I think imagine the current university model is people paying thousands of dollars for Zoom calls, basically. And you can disintermediate the university, as I do in safeatdean.com, and charge people $100 a course or $500 a course or something like that, and still manage to make an excellent an excellent amount of education. So I think these places are kind of digging their own graves with their compliance with this stuff. And so, you know, not going to cry too much. Anybody else want to add anything?
Just regarding what you last said about the school system model and how they shoot themselves in the foot, I give some courses in a business school in France, and actually all my courses have been cancelled and have to take place on Zoom, and the students still pay the same tuition fees, which is really, really high. And basically, I will tell them that it's pretty stupid if they are really interested in the stuff and not only in the diploma, and to because they will just have a kind of a podcast for their money. So they will be better off with getting in your course or just following some people like Stefan Livera and people like that on YouTube?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's people like that for everything. You know, you can learn anything online. At the end of the day, the people who teach everything are people, and you can make a Zoom call with them and you can do it directly and pay them directly, and it just ends up being much, much, much more efficient. Another, of course, another very important point, which is a reason why I wasn't really swept up with the hysteria initially, is that there's just never been such a deadly epidemic as they had been telling us this one would end up. So if you look at the famous epidemic that they always bring up to scare people, is the 1918 influenza flu, Spanish flu, I mean. And that was supposedly killed tens of millions of people, but that was at the end of a world war. And it was, you can't just discount the effect of the world war on this. A lot of people were living in destitution. A lot of soldiers had spent years in battle fronts, basically living in dirt, away from civilization, away from sanitation. And a lot of diseases were developing there. And that's just a completely different situation from what you would expect in a normal society, in a normal modern society. So since we've had modern society with sanitation, with sewage, with running water, and with the introduction of heating and cooling technologies, with all of that stuff, we've eliminated these endemic diseases, and we've also eliminated these deadly pandemics that used to kill a lot of people. That's why we haven't had these things happen in the 20th century anywhere where you have peace and sanitation. I think this combo, if you have peace and sanitation, you don't get deadly diseases that kill masses of people. You will get, you'll still get... You'll still get respiratory diseases every year. You get pneumonia and influenza that are going to kill people every year, and that's going to happen every year. And some years are going to be much worse than other years. So, like, there was the 1957 Hong Kong flu or the Asian flu in 1968, or I may be mixing those two up. But it can happen that you get a very bad year where you get a lot of flus and people dying from respiratory diseases. And that stuff varies every year. And when all is said and done, this year is probably going to end up being one of those years in which we had an exceptionally high illness, exceptionally high number of deaths related to those illnesses. And it may be totally expected because the past couple of years were particularly mild. So nothing out of the ordinary. But all over the world, whenever you get sanitation and peace, this is the case. You don't get these things. Once we have that, people get sick individually, and their health is much more about their own choices and their own life and their own hygiene. You don't get that kind of mass illness and mass death. And the notion that just you can just extrapolate based on that, based on just the early numbers is ridiculous. The fact that people don't first question the premise of extrapolation, and they don't first question the validity of the data initially, and then just proceed to extrapolate and assume that we're going to be getting a massive disease, I think is absolutely insane. In reality, my favorite, in conclusion, these were my initial ideas initially about what's going to happen. And of course, now, you know, we've had 8-9 months, and I think it's clear that this is indeed what has happened, because of the example that, you know, the what we mentioned earlier about the fact that the numbers of the people who are dying are very high, are not very high compared to other years. But also my favorite example is Belarus. Because Belarus is really the perfect control experiment, and it has absolutely nothing to do with their data. Before people say anything, there is absolutely nothing that the government of Belarus can say that will change my mind. And my data on Belarus is not dependent on the government being honest or lying, because we
look at Belarus. I've been following Belarus closely from March when they were the last country, when they were the only country that said, we're not going to do it. And I remember their president, Lukashenko, said, you know, this is ridiculous. We're not going to, I'd rather die fighting than go on my knees. And we are a strong people, the people of Belarus, and I urge the people of Belarus to go to the sauna and drink vodka. And, you know, honestly, I think if you are if you're arguing for any of the other kind of measures, you have a very hard time to find any imperative proof, any empirical support for the notion that anything in the world, anywhere, has worked better than the president telling the population, have vodka and go to the sauna. Because you look at Belarus, since then, you know, we've seen, and I've been following it, the football league started in Belarus in March. And now it's coming to an end. They've played 27 matches in the season. The season is it's going to be, I think, 30 matches long. So it's coming to an end. So you have professional football teams playing in stadia where the fans still show up. They didn't even stop fans from coming. So for now it's been 9 months, 8 months. Fans have been going to the stadium. Fans have been entering the stadium, mixing with each other, coming near the players, and the players keep coming back. It, you know, there's no amount of government lying that can hide the fact that they can't make up fake players. You know, the same team is coming back, and they're getting into a new game, and they keep playing each other, and every team has played the other team twice, and now one team is going to be crowned champion at the end of the season in a couple of weeks. And there isn't a single report of a single player who has suffered anything from coronavirus. And these people did not lock down from then. So you, if you follow football, you can see the match reports. You can see the players who are playing in March. They're still playing in October and in November. And they're still there. They're still alive. So this notion that healthy people were under threat is completely ridiculous. We see in Belarus, church service was still going on. Football was still going on. People were gathering in crowds. We saw that in April, they had a national day of service where I think it was 1 or 2 million people went into the streets, went into nature and planted a million trees or something like that. So this is a country that is the perfect control experiment. And there's absolutely no evidence that suggests that anything out of the ordinary has happened in Belarus this year compared to other years. The total number of deaths in Belarus is going to be no different from what it was in other years. The number of coronavirus deaths and cases is no different from what it is in other countries. The number of people dying in the country overall is going to be similar to previous years. And I mean, this is if you go by government statistics, but even if you don't, you know, we've also had the good fortune of witnessing the, I don't know anything about Belarus politics and I don't care to comment and I don't have any strong opinions, but we had the good fortune of having demonstrations happen in Belarus so that the entire world could see cameras on thousands of people gathered together in streets. And, you know, we still didn't see mass deaths. It's the notion that there will be large numbers of people dying if we don't do social distancing and we don't do lockdown is completely obliterated by Belarus. You only need one example to falsify it. You only need one example to show that this is just completely ridiculous. It's a country that didn't give in to the hysteria at all, and we even continue to have large crowds, even continue to have church. And if you see my Twitter, you know, there's a whole feed where I show what I've been tracking Belarus from April. We have the demonstrations, we have the football matches, we have the church service, all of these things. When you see people, oh, and they also had a military parade on the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. They had a military parade. And, you know, each time I would post this, the corona hysterics would come on my Twitter and respond, all right, we'll check back in 2 weeks and you'll see. And indeed, we come back in 2 weeks and we check. And still no pictures of mass graves in Belarus, no reports of people dying in the streets, no reports of hospitals being overrun. And that at a time when the Belarusian opposition was getting out reports, and I also share that, you know, they're getting out reports about two students in this university were arrested because they're part of the opposition. So, you know, if they can keep track of two students getting arrested, they would be able to show you one picture of a hospital struggling with dead bodies. There's no way that there was a cover-up of a massive number of dead people in Belarus, given the enormous number of pictures that we've seen from the military parade, from the football matches, from all of that stuff. You have to be completely, completely deranged conspiracy theorist to imagine that Belarus has been able to, has been hiding thousands of dead bodies from coronavirus in order to not make people think that that their lockdown has failed. It's absolutely untenable. You cannot believe this. It's quite clear that they've carried on living quite as normal, and nothing has changed in their life. Some people wear masks, but really nothing different, and nothing different in the deaths. So if any of this hocus-pocus lockdown nonsense could work, if any of it had any value, you would have to witness a market difference between Belarus and other countries. You'd have to show me something about Belarus that was different from other countries. And you can't just tell me that, well, Belarus statistics are lies, because even if Belarus statistics are hiding a small number of dead people that are dying from coronavirus, and in fact, but they're not getting listed as it. So what? It's not exactly. The number of deaths that we were promised, the number of deaths that were used to justify lockdown, are enormously higher than anything that can be hidden. That's the key point. So it's not just about whether Belarus has hidden a few hundred or a few thousand people. If the virus really was as dangerous as people are saying it was, then the virus really requires people to lock themselves at home, you'd expect Belarus would have a lot more people dying. You'd expect that it would be impossible to hide the number of deaths. You'd have mass graves. You'd have hospitals struggling to hide bodies. You'd get one guy take out his cell phone and show pictures of dead bodies. And, you know, one of the opposition who works at the hospital says, Lukashenko is crazy and he made us not lock down. And now look, there are all these bodies piling up in the hospitals. We didn't see any of that. It's pretty shocking. Also, I remember my own brother is a doctor, and he works at a hospital in New York. And he was there at that time when hospitals were getting overrun, and he also caught it, and he shook it off in a day. And, you know, the next week I was speaking to him, I told him, you know, are you sure you didn't catch it yet? He said, no, I think I caught it last week. And that was it. He didn't get tested, but he's pretty sure based on the symptoms and based on what he got that pretty much he did get it. And he was sick for a night, but he was fine the next day. And, you know, that stuff happens. And I think, you know, this... for me, it's a vindication of what I've had as a hunch, in that your health, what matters to your health much more than any kind of micro droplet flying in the sky, what matters much more to your health is your own decisions with what you do with your body, in particular what you stuff your body with, in particular the inflammatory foods that are a major pain in the ass for your immune system to handle. And this is something that I've known from my own experience. You know, when I eat well, when I'm eating well, I just don't catch the cold. I don't get the flu. It's just not common that I would get these illnesses. And I remember, you know, I'd be, when I worked at university, you know, it would be common that in winter a lot of people would get sick, and it would be not very common that I would get it. And it's very rare that I would catch a flu, because I would be eating healthy. And I'd see it when people don't eat well. I feel it with myself. If I do that, I become more susceptible to infections. And it makes a lot of sense. if you're stuffing your body with things that are toxic for your body, with things that are not good for your body, your immune system and your defense systems in your body are being exhausted trying to fix the damage that you're doing to it from that. So when an outside attacker like a virus comes and attacks your body, you know, you're going to suffer much more because your immune system is out of shape. Your immune system is exhausted. It's overworked. Whereas if you're using food in order to feed your body, if you're strengthening yourself, making yourself stronger and giving yourself more and more food, then your body's going to get, your body's going to have a much better chance at fighting those things. And that's why the vast majority of young, healthy people who got this shook it off in a day or two or three, depending on how long it, you know. But I know another friend who's a carnivore, and he also got it and shook it off in a couple of days. So I don't think there's anything different about this illness than what we see in regular years. And the only difference is that they simply extrapolated what it does to very sick and old people to what it would be doing to the rest of the world. It's absolutely amazing. It's really incredible when you think about how much damage this hysteria is going to cause, and how much it's going to how many livelihoods are going to be ruined based on this insane fear of this pathogen that's just going to come flying out of thin air and infect healthy people and decimate them.
Just a quick one. Really interesting story about Belarus there. What are the best sources for us to go and find out more about this kind of thing? More examples?
Honestly, I don't know why nobody brings up Belarus except me. And I have a Twitter thread that has been running from April until today, in which I just collect pictures and articles of, you know, demonstration in Belarus, military parade, cup final in Belarus. And, you know, I come back in 2 weeks later. Nope, still nothing shows up. We look at the data, nothing shows up. You know, demonstrations continue for several weeks, and we don't hear about all those mass deaths that should follow. It's interesting. Nobody wants to talk about it as well. I think a lot of people are just inclined to think, well, you know, Belarus is a dictatorship, so we don't know what their data is really like, and so we can't really be sure. But no, we know enough to tell there's no mass graves, and there's no, there's no crisis that's being caused by this illness. Nothing like what the hysterics told us would happen. Like, if you remember April, March, February, the corona hysterics were adamant that, you know, the hospitals are going to be overrun, and even if you have any other kind of injury, you won't be able to go into the hospital, and society is going to fall apart, and we're going to have people dying in the streets if we don't lock down. And none of that has happened anywhere, regardless of whether they locked down or not. And I would also add, more than just Belarus, I think an important point and a falsification of this is all of the poor countries in the world that just simply cannot do social distancing. Not countries, poor parts of countries that cannot do social distancing. You know, there are slums in the world in which people live, you know, seven people live in a room. And that's it. You know, so there's no social distancing there. And also the neighbors live in the room that is right next to us. And so the notion that everybody is going to just stay 6 feet away from everybody everywhere in the world is ridiculous. And it's this kind of silly fantasy that only central planners can think up. In the poor world, people are stuck next to each other. They don't have a lot of space. They don't have a lot of ability to isolate. And yet we still didn't see or hear of any one single place of these places that that cannot socially distance. We don't hear about any outbreak of mass death taking place in any of those places. And still, again, nobody likes to talk about that. And of course, also we have the protests that happened in June in the US, Black Lives Matter protests, which were quite huge and had massive crowds. And still, they did not lead to massive spikes. And we have all the examples of the places that have opened up after initially locking down, like Florida, for instance. And we see they've opened up and things are fine and normal. So really, there are so many dogs that didn't bark like they should have barked if the corona hysteria story would have been correct. You know, they needed one example. There's also Nicaragua. There's also Turkmenistan. There's also, what else? Uruguay. Oh, yeah, Uruguay as well. Oh, Uruguay didn't have a lockdown. All of these examples, and they don't have one single example from the entire planet where they can point to this and say, look, these guys didn't lock down. And because of that, look, here are the hospitals overflowing. Here's the doomsday that we had told you would come. We can't find that anywhere in the world, regardless of what happened with lockdown or not. But what we can find is that the places that have had very bad lockdowns have also had some of the highest rates of mortality anywhere in the world. So Argentina and Peru are two of the world's toughest lockdowns, and they've had an enormous amount of deaths. And of course, one wonders, you know, how many of these deaths are actually caused by corona, and how many of these are actually caused by the lockdowns. And I think, you know, the economic devastation that is happening because of the lockdowns probably already killed many, many more, if you really think about the long-term effects. I think most pertinent, I would say, malaria and tuberculosis. Tuberculosis might be the big one, because tuberculosis depends on mortality with tuberculosis is highly dependent on early detection and treatment. And so when you've locked down hospitals and locked people at home, you've prevented a lot of people from being detected early. So I think what's going to happen with tuberculosis over the next few years is going to be probably pretty bad. And it'll be interesting to see how much extra mortality that causes. Yeah, Peter?
Yeah. Yeah, that's... I think there's... Even if we just think about the kind of more direct deaths like the tuberculosis you mentioned, that's the case. But also what people never seem to think about is the much longer term impact, you know, from reductions in economic growth and the associations there are with health income. Impacts and economic growth, and what we're doing by killing economic growth across the world, it's likely to impact on millions of people relative to the counterfactual of not having it. So yeah, you can consider the direct case, but there's also that likely much, much bigger indirect case and the health outcomes associated with that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, I was one of the people who was shouting about this all the way back in March and getting called, you know, those criminal libertarians, heartless libertarians who cares more about money than he cares about lives. And these idiots don't understand that economy is livelihood and livelihood is life and survival. But there's such an enormous number of idiots who are so completely separated from the real economy of life because they work fake jobs where, you know, they don't produce anything of value and they get paid in fiat. They're completely separated from understanding that in the real world, you have to produce before you can consume. And if you don't produce, you can't consume. They think, you know, consumption is what happens because society gives you a salary, and society gives you salary because that's because you're so special and you were born into a social contract and society gives you money. And then you do your part by turning up and doing other people's work. And that's how society functions. And so, you know, if you have an excuse to not do your work, you're still going to get fed because, you know, society is still going to owe you because you're so special and nice. They don't have a conception of economic production. And I think a lot of Wall Street types as well can be a victim to this because, you know, they see economics as just numbers on the screen and they don't see the relationship it has for people. And in this, in a world in which you can make or lose a lot of money quickly, you know, you don't see the separation, you don't see the link. You can use and gain a lot of money and still be rich. And you don't see the link where people who are poor, they can lose money enough to actually kill them. You know, they could actually starve. If you, that volatility, if you lose a little bit of income, you could fall below the ability to, your ability to provide for yourself. And it's just completely, it's lost on people because people become idiots when they're scared. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure we're going to be discussing more and more about this depressing topic on Monday. On Monday's seminar, James Todaro will be joining us, and he will tell us from another angle. From his perspective, he found evidence to suggest that a drug was effective, and then all hell broke loose. So he's going to give us another perspective on fiat science, and you know how it relates to this disease and what to do about it. So do join us in on Monday, and thank you guys for joining for today. It was a good conversation. Enjoyed it.